Excuse me.
The Jews believed that?
What?
The Jews believed that?
No, but the Romans did. And oh. But the Romans controlled Jerusalem. They were the conquerors of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. They were upset that the Jews wouldn't put up statues of the Roman gods and everything, you know. But they didn't like that. So all these things, the exile of the Jews into the other nations when the Romans came in and destroyed Israel, the movement of the Christians into all the nations to fulfill what Jesus told them to do, go forth and make disciples of all nations. So all these things were kind of a very missionary kind of a thing. One group was escaping the Romans. The other was a missionary thing going into all the world to proclaim. And as they would go into places, some of the Jews were already there. And so they would get in these arguments with the Jews when they would start talking about Jesus. It talks about that in the Acts of the Apostles too, how they'd go in and start talking about Jesus and they get into these fights.
Didn't they, before Jesus died, didn't he say that when he was separating himself from the Jews, didn't he say that you would become a wandering people? And I guess maybe it took place around 70 AD that they became wanderers.
I don't think he ever told them they'd be a wandering people.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure.
We gotta look it up.
Yeah. I don't remember him saying that in the Gospels.
I thought he had said that the Jews would become wanderers of the earth, won't have a homeland. And I thought in 70 AD it happened. And he said also, I thought that when they do get a home back, it'll be the beginning of the end of the earth.
Well, they got a home back after World War II.
I know, 1948.
And so they were able to go back there, but they're still having problems, as you even today, you know.
But they do have
a home. They're also trying to. It's interesting because the Jews want to build the third temple, and they can't build the third temple until they find the urn that has the ashes of the heifers that were sacrificed when they did the first two temples. So they had this. They had to find an unblemished calf. Mm-hmm. And they've been trying to find an unblemished calf for a long time. They thought they found one in New York a few years ago, but it turned out to be blemished. And so they haven't found one yet. But if they ever find an unblemished calf, all hell's going to break loose. Because what they're trying to find is that, so they've been doing these excavations under the old temple. And they call it an archaeological dig, but what they're really trying to find is that urn, because they have to add the ashes of the unblemished calf of the third temple to the ashes of the first two temples in this urn. They did find the incense. They found a block of that incense that they have to burn in the temple. It's 600 pounds, a big cube. It lasts for a year. They cut a chunk of it off, and they would burn it in the morning, and then it would burn in the evening. And so they found that, but they haven't found this urn yet. But
what would be an unblemished
calf?
Jim just asked the same question. What's an unblemished calf? You know, I don't know.
It's not like an albino.
No, it's not like an albino or anything. It can't have any kind of defect of any kind. And I don't know what that means in a cow. You know, I don't know what an unblemished calf looks like.
He grew up on a dairy farm.
You know, I really, because to me, I see a lot of calves and they all, look kind of unblemished to me, you know. So I think they're cute as can be. But I don't know what an unblemished calf looks like. But if they ever find one, it's going to...
Then we'll
know what it is, you know. But you see, that's why when Jesus was crucified, it says the Paschal lamb is an unblemished lamb with no broken bones or anything like that. It can't have any defects in it, no broken bones, no nothing. And that's why they weren't able to break his legs. And that's why they didn't break any bones when they were going through his passion and everything. Because he had to, because all those things in the scriptures had to be fulfilled, you know? And so all this stuff had to happen. So this exile presented a challenge to formulate a clear and positive doctrine about worship. What should worship be? What should it include? And the new thing that was to come, for there was no more temple anymore. So where do you do the worship? So we had to wait till Constantine came in as emperor so we could start building churches and stuff. So for a time, they had to use houses the way the Jews had to use a tent as they were moving across the desert until they got to where they could build the temple. And there was no more form of public and communal worship as required by law. Israel now stood before God with empty hands. They couldn't have any more communal worship or anything else. No more public worship or anything like that. So it was quite a challenge for them. So Israel, looking at both Israel and the Christians, Israel did the only thing she could do. She offered her sufferings, the cry of her broken heart, her persistent pleading before the silent God as the new fatted sacrifice, the new burnt offerings. She offered herself as the sacrifice.
What?
Benedict.
Oh.
That wasn't something I made up. That's something he says in his
book. There was a biblical.
No, it's something he says in his book. He says, Israel's worship now became her heavy heart and empty hands, a representative worship in place of the temple oblations. And that's all they have today, because they don't have a temple anymore. All they have is synagogues. So they have a worship where they get together and they read scripture, they teach, they sing songs and all. But it's a representative worship. There's no more sacrifice. There's no more temple. There's no more burning of incense and stuff like this. There's no more Holocaust offered to God or anything.
Does that bother them? I mean, do they feel there's something missing? You know, they don't have the old
temple. Well, yeah. Why do you think they're digging under the temple to find that urn? If they could find it. I've got a book at home called The Third Temple, and it's all about the expectations of the Jews to build that that third temple.
Yeah.
And it's going to be, if they ever find this, if they find the urn and find an unblemished calf, you're going to see a holy war like you've never seen before, because they're going to do everything they can to kick all the Muslims out of Israel. You know, to take the Temple Mount. That's the big mosque. They're going to level that thing. And it's going to be a holy war like you've never seen before.
But that was built where the temple was.
Yeah. It's built on top of the temple. Right. And the Muslims did that on purpose.
Right.
Because to irritate the Jews, you know. They didn't build it somewhere else. They built it right on top of the temple area. Mm. And so that rankles the Jews, as you can well imagine.
Maybe the urn is under that, huh?
Excuse me.
Yes.
Yeah, Google is our friend.
Good.
About that perfect calf.
Uh-huh.
It has to be a red heifer.
A red
must
heifer.
Must be absolutely perfect in redness. Even two hairs of any other color will disqualify it.
Okay.
So it has, all this hair has to be red.
Okay.
It has to be 3 or 4 years old. Although older animals could be used, younger could not.
It must
be free of any kind of internal or external defect or blemish. It must not have been used for any type of physical labor, never been under the yoke, not even once.
Okay.
There you go.
There you
That's
go. There you go. That's what the unblemished heifer. Yeah, he Googled it. Unblemished heifer is. So our friend Alan from the Philippines. It's got to be red and no other color at all. And so I don't know where you find a totally red heifer, but that would have to be it. And it has to be a certain age. Could never have had a yoke on it or anything. So that's a pretty good description of what a perfect. So that's why it's so hard to find an unblemished calf, because you know, you find one, it's probably going to have a little white hair on it somewhere.
Or and not used as labor.
That's right, not used as labor, right. So if I was younger, I could have been an unblemished hair, because I had red hair. You know, but when I had hair. But
you'd be a young bull, James.
I'd be a young bull, that's right.
They did say older you could use.
So that's kind of what they're looking for, though. But I don't think they'll ever fight. I don't think God will let that happen. He doesn't want a war. Mm-hmm. You know, he wants salvation. He doesn't want people fighting. But that's what they're looking for. So they're digging under the excavations, trying to find this urn. They found the incense. Now they got to find a, you know, unblemished calf. That's going to be hard to find. They also, another thing that's really curious is that back in the time of Jesus and before, when the Jews would make their prayer shawls, they had the ones that were really the ones that were most sought after were white with blue, the blue covering. Mm-hmm. The blue covering was made with the blood of a certain kind of a snail. It had blue blood. So I guess they had a lot of copper in it, you know. Mm-hmm. That's usually what happens. Mm-hmm. Insects that have blue blood have usually high copper content. Mm-hmm. Well, at a point in time after the crucifixion and stuff, all those snails disappeared. They went away. And it was a very expensive thing to do because each snail only had a little bit of blood. Mm-hmm. So they have to draw it out, you know, and stuff like, so they use it for dye. And a couple of years ago, they started finding them again.
Hmm.
So people said, oh man, mm-hmm. you know, things are coming back. So they gave a lot of people hope that mm-hmm. some other stuff would come back too, you know. But it's interesting that the blue coloring was from the snail blood. I've got a couple of prayer shawls that I bought because I did a class on prayer shawls one time, and it shows how they have to do the knotting of the tassels and stuff like this. In the Gospels, it talks about the woman with the hemorrhage, and she touched the hem of Jesus' cloak. She didn't touch the hem of his cloak. She touched the tassel of his garment, because the Jewish tradition tells that the power of the prayer shawl is sent through the tassels. And so when Jesus said, I felt the power come through me, that's what he was talking about there. So she was on the ground trying to reach down there and touch those tassels of his prayer shawl. And there's a certain way you got to tie them, and there's a certain blessing you got to say when you put it on, all this kind of stuff. But those kind of things are very interesting. But those are very expensive items. Now, the ones I got are blue and white, too. But I don't think it's because when I look what I paid for them, I don't think it was the blood of the snail. It would have cost a heck of a lot more if that was the case. But they are pretty. And when I go to Eucharistic worship sometimes, you know, I like to wear it. Because you put it on and it kind of blocks out everything from the side. You can kind of focus on what you're doing, you know. And Jesus wore one, so it kind of makes you feel like you're one with him. But they had two kinds. They had the short ones that would just kind of go over your shoulders. Then they had the long ones that would go almost all the way down to the ground. So I got one of each for the class to show. Anyway, that's beside the point, right? We're talking about liturgy, not prayer shawls. So Israel's worship now became her heavy heart. And so we saw this, you know, and that's why I admire the Jewish people that are observant Jews so much. Because in spite of all the things they went through, the people that are still holding on to that religion and still observing it, still going to synagogue, still praying, still waiting for that Messiah, you know, that takes a lot of courage to do that, you know. So I got all the respect in the world for the Jews that are still, you know, doing that.
I grew up in Manhattan in an apartment building, and on the main floor there was a Jewish doctor. They had 13 children, and they used to build the little house when it was
the Feast of Tabernacles. Yeah.
They would put it between two buildings. They would actually build the straw house.
Yeah.
And he kept the Sabbath holy. He wouldn't open a door. He wouldn't make visits, and people would hold his medical bag. And we really admired and revered that man.
Yeah.
And he picked out all the Christians for the daughters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they really lived the old biblical faith.
Yeah.
Really, it was amazing.
It is amazing.
If he came to someone in the apartment building, mm-hmm. it would always be free of charge as a doctor's visit.
Wow.
Yeah, nice. Amazing man.
Yeah, that is. Mm-hmm. And to think of all they've been through with the Holocaust and everything else, you know, it's amazing that they still are able to do that. Yeah. I got a lot of respect for those people. I really do. So in Alexandria, so that's one of the places where they were spreading out to. In Alexandria, the Jews eventually made contact with the Greek thinking. they encounter these Greek philosophers. The Jews were not philosophers. They had the revelation from God, you know, given through Abraham and the rest, the prophets and all. But they were not philosophers. The Greeks were philosophers. Aristotle, like as we saw in the beginning of this series, was the one who reasoned to the fact that God has to be one and he's got to be eternal. And, you know, and so they had the Aristotle, you know, problem that Benedict talked about. But they eventually came in contact with the Greek thinking, and from then on, the concept of latria, enthusia, worship and sacrifice with spirit and mind came about, which we see in Romans 12:1, Paul's letter to the Romans. Then Israel's suffering during the exile in the Hellenistic period first brought the word of prayer into prominence as the equivalent of exterior sacrifice. So they morphed from exterior sacrifice, you know, offering up animals and stuff, into prayer. So all their worship kind of morphed into prayer. The whole philosophy of the Logos, the Word of God, in the Greek world is incorporated into this concept, because God's speaking through his Logos and they're speaking back to him through the Logos. The Greek mind elevates it and eventually to the idea of a mystical union with the Logos, the very meaning of all things. And that's what we do today as well. We look at our worship, and our ultimate goal is to be in mystical union with God. That's why we have the mystical body of Christ. And then when we get to heaven, we go into full, complete mystical marriage with God, mystical union with God. And at that point, we share in the divine life of the Trinity. That's what the Church Fathers tell us. What that's like, we have no clue. John talks about that in his letters. He says, "Well, right now we're children of God. What we'll be then, we don't know. But we'll see God as he is." So at least on that level. So we're God's adopted children. Jesus is God's child by natural means. And so that makes him our brother, makes us part of the family of God. He wants all of us in his family. So the Church Fathers call the Eucharist prayer the sacrifice of the Word. So when they would talk about the Eucharist, they would talk about it as prayer, the sacrifice of the Word, the prayerful offering of the Word to God the Father. They go beyond the Greek idea of the sacrifice of the Logos and provide an answer to the question left open by the Old Testament theology, which made prayer the equivalent of sacrifice. A striking conflict is thus evident in the great Old Testament movement toward worship in the Word. There is an expectation of a restoration of the temple in purified form, but something is still missing. So there's this expectation of this new temple, but something is missing. What's missing? The idea of the sacrifice of the Logos, sacrifice of Christ, becomes a full reality only when the Logos is incarnated. Full reality only in the Logos incarnatus, the Word who is made flesh and draws all flesh into the glorification of God. So what God is going to do to us when he brings us into heaven is to glorify us. Paul talks a little bit about this in one of his letters, about our body being glorified. And of course, Jesus' body was glorified when he rose from the dead. But Father Gately has a book, The Three is One, and he talks about that a lot in his book, too. It's a really, really good book. It's not a long book, but it's a really good book. It's called The Three is One. It's about the Trinity. And he talks about our relationship with Jesus and who he is for us. And he talks about how right now we talk about Jesus as our Savior, our Redeemer, and stuff. But he poses the question, well, when you get to heaven, who's he going to be? Because you're already redeemed, you're already saved. Mm. What's the relationship then going to be? He's then going to be your glorifier. And that means he takes you into the life of the Trinity itself. And that's something we have no clue what that's like.
Now, I always think of Elizabeth of the Trinity. She was really into the Trinity. Mm-hmm. And I've read books about it. But that's hard to even imagine. You know, because she's lived a lot of that on Earth in her daily in the Trinity. But somehow we're all involved in it anyway, because when we receive communion, we receive the Trinity.
Right.
So we're working around with it's the Trinity. We're,
yeah. Well, don't forget what Jesus told us in our study of divine mercy, that if we expect to get to heaven, we have to start living our divine life here on earth. We start living eternity on earth. So, and the Blessed Mother talks about that in one of her messages at Medjugorje. She says, if you live the life that I'm calling you to live, when you do die, you won't even notice it. It'll be like just a simple passing on to the next, you know, walking through one from one room to another room, going through a door. It won't be this agonizing, thing. I think people are afraid of dying more than they're more of the process of dying than they are of dying.
What happens after?
You know,
my cousin actually said that to me. Mm-hmm. That's what she said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if you can get over yourself and don't worry about the process, then just think of the next step after I die, I'm going to meet Jesus face to face. I'm going to be face to face with the one who loves me infinitely.
Easier said than done.
That's got to be something exciting, you know?
I think that's why there's so much fear with the pandemic. They're so afraid.
Yeah, the people are very afraid, yeah.
You just think of
So he's going to draw all flesh into the glorification of God. When that happens, the Logos is more than just the meaning behind and above things. Now he himself has entered into flesh. He became incarnate, has become man. He takes up into himself our sufferings. Look at what he suffered. And then hope and bears it to God. He takes our sufferings and hope and then takes them up to God. So John Paul II wrote a book on the threshold of hope. You know, he talks about never lose hope. Mm-hmm. Never lose hope. Never lose, and Jesus tells us in the Divine Mercy thing we saw, never lose trust. You know, so all those things that Jesus keeps telling us, we really have to take to heart. You know, never stop hoping and never lose trust in him. Because he wants the best for you. So in Jesus' self-surrender on the cross, the Word is united with the entire reality of human life and suffering. He totally united himself to all of us. And so that begs the question that Paul raises in one of his letters when he says, I suffer in my body what Jesus was unable to suffer in his. Because his body was limited, you know, like any other man. He couldn't suffer everything. He didn't have cancer. He didn't have diabetes and all the rest of the stuff we suffer from. But he did suffer greatly and sufficiently, obviously. So why does our suffering have any meaning? When we suffer, what's good about that?
We're united.
Offered.
And what happens when you do that?
You offer it up.
You become closer to Jesus. You become.
What is the
home? His redemptive work. The cross was redemption. We share in his redemption.
Exactly.
We're involved with him.
Exactly. Jesus only died for one purpose, for our redemption. So when he allows us to offer him our suffering, to unite it to his, what's he doing? He's allowing us to share in that redemptive work. So every time we suffer and offer it to Christ, we're sharing in the redemption of other people we haven't even met. We'll meet them when we get to heaven. Because somehow or other, God's going to let us know or meet them that we helped redeem.
So do you think when we don't think that way, we're wasting ourselves?
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. If you just suffer and that's it, then you're wasting your suffering. That's the whole idea of spirituality behind suffering. There's a certain spirituality of suffering. That if all you do is suffer and it's all it is, it's worthless.
And Protestants don't really understand our Catholic thinking.
That's right. That's why they always pray, don't let me suffer. That's why they're willing to do euthanasia and stuff like that. You know, because they don't want to suffer. But suffering is a privilege in many ways, when you think about it. Because it's something that you can offer to God that helps redeem somebody else who might not be redeemed if you didn't do that.
And thank God for the, if you went to Catholic school. I mean, yeah. Kindergarten, first grade, they would always say, you offer up your sufferings to
that's
Jesus.
Right.
And we
that's
didn't fully understand
taught.
It. But well, we knew it was ingrained.
Well, my mother told me that every day.
Yes.
Whenever I stub my toe, offer it up.
Oh, that's right.
That was her favorite saying, offer it up. So in Jesus' self-suffering on the cross, the Word is united with the entire reality of human life and suffering. And so he's uniting all of our suffering to his, but we have to make that offering. We have to offer it to him. So that our suffering is our gift to Jesus. So every day, when I have all my aches and pains, you know, I'm 81 years old, I've got lots of aches and pains.
More next week, folks.
Yeah, yeah. I've got two herniated discs in my back that are pushing on my sciatic nerves, so I wake up in the morning, I can barely make it to the bathroom half the time.
And
what?
More next week. She said more next week. Why? Why did you say
oh, yeah.
It's because we don't...
It never ends.
It
never ends, right.
It changes.
Oh, yeah.
I always had every, you know, this, that, this, that, a little, not a serious thing. And my husband's like, what's wrong with you today?
He took it very seriously, didn't he? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We laughed a lot.
Yeah.
So the sacrifice of Jesus takes us up and leads us into that likeness with God. The more we offer up ourselves to him, the more like him we become within ourselves. Not like we become like him exteriorly, but interiorly. Our soul becomes more like him. And that's a transformation caused by love. And that's the important thing. Everything God does, he does because of love.
I never heard a homily to discuss that issue. Pain.
Uh-huh. Excuse me.
And that's at 90. Hmm. Can you imagine? We still have a lot here.
I thought I'd put it on.
We still
okay, we're
that.
Back. That was just my pharmacy. Okay, so the idea is that God, because he loves us so much and wants us to love him, he uses our love for him, which is the basis for our offering of our sufferings to him, as the way to transform us interiorly and become more and more like him. So when Adam and Eve fell, you know, God made us into his image and likeness. We kept the image, but not the likeness. And so all of our spiritual growth is trying to regain that likeness that was lost. So we come closer and closer and closer to it. John Paul II, in his teachings on the theology of the body, talks about trying to get back to that state of original innocence that Adam and Eve were in. And he said we can't ever get all the way back there, but we try to get as close to that as we can to get back there. And that's the thing that's all of our spiritual growth is getting closer and closer and closer to that state that Adam and Eve were in with, when they had that original innocence, when they walked with God and stuff. And then when we get to heaven, we'll have the full perfection of that, even beyond what, you know, Adam and Eve had, of course. So the Eucharist is that meeting point of all these lines that lead from the Old Covenant, indeed from our whole religious history, into Christ, and through him into us. Here at last we have the right kind of worship, always longed for, yet surpassing our own powers. We always longed for that, but it was always surpassed our own. We could never do it on our own. God had to do it for us. So we have adoration now in spirit and truth. Somebody's talking in the background.
Another little class.
If you're talking in the background, mute yourself. Unless you have something to say for our class. So liturgical form, that's what we're still talking about. So Christian worship, he's talking about how that developed. So Christian worship, the liturgy of the Christian faith, cannot be viewed simply as a Christianization of the synagogue service, because it's not. You know, it's not at all that. Christian worship regards the destruction of the temple as final and theologically necessary. We had to get rid of the temple so we could have our tabernacle. The temple was the place where God lived. The tabernacle is now the place where God lives. Christian worship regards the destruction of the temple as final, theologically necessary. The temple is replaced by the universal temple of the risen Christ, whose outstretched arms draw all men into the embrace of eternal love. So, you know, St. Paul tells us, do you not know that you are a temple of the Holy Spirit? So not only do we have a new temple, so to speak, in the tabernacle where Christ lives, but we also have the indwelling Trinity, where the Trinity resides within us as walking temples, walking tabernacles. So the new temple already exists. There's no reason to build a third temple. So they'll probably never find us perfect ever. And so does the definitive sacrifice. The definitive sacrifice was the sacrifice of Christ. The humanity of Christ opened up in his cross and his resurrection. So the prayer of Jesus is now united with the dialogue of eternal love within the Trinity. And so the sacrifice of Jesus takes us up and leads us into that likeness with God. So through his sacrifice and the sacrifices that we offer to him for all the things we suffer, leads us into that transformation, which is the only true adoration. So Jesus draws men into this prayer through the Eucharist, the ever-open door of adoration and the true sacrifice. So this whole, the whole prayer that we offer God, and you know, the church fathers say your life should be a prayer. Everything you, and they say make all your work prayer. And how do you do that? You offer it to God. Prayer is offering to God. You don't have to say words. Contemplation is prayer without words, right? And so when you pray, you're making an offering to God, and that's the essential element of prayer. It's some offering you're making to God in some form, either vocal prayer, meditative prayer, contemplative prayer, whatever. But we do it through the Eucharist, because we do it. Because the Eucharist is the sum and summit of our faith. John Paul II wrote an encyclical on that. And so everything we do in our religious life, we do in and through the Eucharist. And that's why the church says, you know, go to Mass as often as you can. Receive the Eucharist every day if you can. You know, do it as often as you possibly can. It's nice if you live in a place like New York City, where there's a Catholic church about every two blocks. I did a consulting job for Citibank up there. I was staying in the Twin Towers. It's about five blocks from Wall Street. So I'd go from the towers. I'd pass three churches on the way to so I'd go to Mass in the morning on the way. You know, the church is full. Everybody was going to Mass in the morning. Well, yeah, it was a while ago.
50s,
60s,
yeah.
It was probably in the 80s, early 90s. Yeah.
And I bet
they're closed. Yeah, because that was right before I went to Medjugorje. Mm-hmm. And I went to Medjugorje in 1995.
It was every seven blocks in New York City where I lived, by the George Washington Bridge, there was a church.
Yeah.
It was at least 7 blocks.
Yeah, it really amazed me. And all the churches were filled. Yeah. A lot of people go to Mass in the morning there, you know, because it's so convenient.
Yeah.
So in modern theological discussion, the exclusive model for the New Covenant liturgy has been thought to be the synagogue in strict opposition to the temple. And that's just not correct. That's, you know, Benedict tells us it's not a Christianization of the synagogue. It's not it at all. The effect has been disastrous in that kind of thinking, because that's how you get to thinking that the Mass is a meal and not a sacrifice. And he talked about that earlier, if you remember. The priesthood and sacrifice are no longer intelligible. The inner unity of the two testaments disappears. So I wish more people would read Benedict. You know, he's such a smart guy. He's got such really amazing things. So universality is an essential feature of Christian worship. That's why they call us the Catholic Church, the universal church, right? It is never just an event in the life of a community in a particular place. Eucharistic worship embraces heaven and earth. And what does the church teach? At the consecration, the veil between heaven and earth opens up. Holy Spirit comes down on the altar. The connection between the heavenly liturgy and the earthly liturgy, you know, is united. Mankind's movement toward Christ is met by Christ's movement toward men. Christ moved toward us, became man. We now move toward him, ask him to draw us to himself. Christ wants to unite mankind and bring about the one church, the one divine assembly of all men. What does Jesus say in the gospel? He wants one flock and one shepherd. Everything then comes together, the communion of all who worship in spirit and truth. Christian liturgy is a liturgy on the way. It's not a final. It's a work in progress, as people say. A liturgy of pilgrimage toward the transfiguration of the world, which will take place when God is all in all. So we're looking forward to the second coming of Christ, the recreation of heaven and earth. And so the whole liturgy of the church is a movement toward those dramatic events. And that's, and what Benedict is leading to here in this part of his statement is that he says when we modify the liturgy, we should only modify it in recognition of the second coming, that we're closer and closer to that second coming. We should recognize that we're that much closer now to that event. So time and space in liturgy. The time of the New Testament is a peculiar kind of in-between, a mixture of already and not yet. It's stuff about, you know, what's happened in salvation history and what is yet to still come in salvation history. It is leading us to the New Jerusalem in heaven that needs no temple and whose light is God. But the city is not yet here. If you remember from our study of Revelation, when we get to the end of the book, it talks about the New Jerusalem coming down. And it's the beautiful city, but there's no temple. You don't need a temple because there's no more sacrifice in heaven. I always wonder, what does a priest do in heaven? You're a priest forever, you know? So we'll find out. I'm sure there's a role for priests in heaven. The New Testament as the between time gives liturgical theology its specific form. It's where we are today in our spiritual life, and then also anticipation of where we're headed. What is God drawing us to? When Jesus says, I will draw all men to myself, he didn't just mean he was going to only do it on the cross. It starts there. But then after that, he's still drawing all of us to himself. Liturgy has to be rooted in the past, because you got to know where you came from, and have a living contemporary life, because you got to know where you are. But the perpetual takes place in the crucifixion and resurrection, which happened only once for all, but leads us to the final end. That's the doorway. The crucifixion and resurrection was the doorway that leads us into everything else. St. Bernard tells us that the once for all is bound up with the everlasting. So he did it once for all, but that was the open door. Remember in the gospel, he talks about the shepherd and he opens the gate, and my sheep follow me, and, you know, all those kind of things. So we're always supposed to be following him. And he gives us all these hints in the Gospels about this stuff, you know. So today embraces the whole time of the church. In the today of the church, we have presented to us through the Eucharist the far-reaching power of what is present and what is our future. It is the anticipation of eternity. It's not about replacement, but about representation, vicarious sacrifice. That's not my phone. That's somebody else's. Is that Mary? Please mute your thing, Mary. She always forgets to mute. So the liturgy, therefore, is not about sacrificing animals of something ultimately alien to me, but it's about offering the one sacrifice of Christ and then offering ourselves to him, to be part of that. Liturgy is founded on the passion endured by a man who with his eye, letter I, not eyeball, reaches into the mystery of the living God himself by the man who is the Son. So it can never be a mere action. Its origin also bears within it its future. The mystical body is reality. Mary, mute your system. So the mystical body is reality. And what is the mystical body? Mystical body is all of us, all the souls in purgatory, all the souls in heaven. The church militant, the church suffering, the church triumphant. We're all part of the mystical body of Christ. So becoming contemporary with the passion of, with the Paschal sacrifice of Christ in the liturgy of the church is also an anthropological reality. The Mass is not just a rite, not just some liturgical game. Jesus' self-giving becomes mine because we unite ourselves to him. He's calling us into that spiritual marriage so that when he offers himself, he's also offering us. So as the priest prepares the offering at Mass to do the consecration, we should be saying, please unite me to yourself, so that when you are offered to the Father, unite me to the Father with you as your gift to him.
And when the priest pours a little water, does that represent us?
When he pours a little water into the chalice, mm-hmm. that's symbolizing the water and wine, the water and blood that came from the side of Christ. And then after the consecration, he breaks off a piece of the host, you remember, drops that into the chalice. Mm-hmm. That's representation of the fact that after the consecration, the entire Christ is present in the Eucharist, regardless of whether you receive the chalice or the host. So that's a symbolic reuniting of the body and blood of Christ. And so we have that in both the host and the chalice. Of course, that happens instantaneously at the time of the consecration.
In the first church I grew up in, when I grew up in the 40s, people didn't go to communion very often. It was kind of a rare event.
Really?
Yeah, it was.
Because they didn't think they were worthy, right?
Well, you had to go to confession,
right.
Even when the children went to Mass, they didn't have a church. They went to Mass in an auditorium, but they couldn't give communion there. So if you wanted communion that day, you had to not go to the children's Mass. You went to another Mass.
This was a Catholic church?
What state?
Yeah, I guess so.
What state?
Yeah.
Massachusetts.
Oh, really?
Boston.
Oh, really? Mm. Oh, yeah, that's what you saw.
Yeah. And
that's surprising.
But when you did receive the host, it was wet with the blood of Christ.
They don't?
It was. Now, since then, I don't think I've ever received the host that was wet with the blood of Christ.
Aren't you not supposed to dunk?
Yeah, you have.
Well, it's funny how people
oh, yeah.
You get both, regardless of what you get.
Like, I
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, well, they got several ways you can do that. Regardless of whether you receive the host or the chalice, you get the entire, you know, Christ.
Right.
But there's also a way to receive called intinction,
right,
where you dip a host in the mm-hmm. in the chalice and then you take it. But you can only receive on the tongue that way. You can't receive in the hand.
There you go. We are not, but the priest can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the priest has to dip it in the thing and give it to you on the tongue.
Okay.
So Jesus' self-giving of himself to the Father becomes mine because we unite ourselves to him and ask him to unite, to offer us to the Father as well as his gift to the Father. My interior contemporaneity is united with the self-giving of Christ. That's why in the early church, martyrdom was regarded as a real Eucharistic celebration. You are offering all of yourself to Christ in martyrdom. One of the priests in our diocese, he was a Marine chaplain. I forget which parish he's in now. But he said he always wished when he would go serve with the Marines that he had become a martyr, because he said, boy, that's a doorway straight to heaven. Don't go to purgatory. You don't pass go. You go, boom, you're straight up there, you know. So he always wished he would become a martyr. So according to St. Paul, our bodies become a living sacrifice united to the sacrifice of Christ. He talks about that in Romans chapter 12. The sacrifice becomes complete when the world has become the place of love, as St. Augustine saw in his City of God. We've got a long way to go before the world becomes the place of love. Our liturgy has to lead us to this condition of love. So one of the functions of liturgy is to lead us into living a life of love of other people. And that's why this says in the Gospels, you know, you will know, you'll recognize them by the way they love one another.
And we do it in such small ways.
That's
yeah.
Right.
It's so amazing. It's
very
small. Things.
Yeah, little small things. Yeah,
that's
little
right.
Small things.
Small things matter.
That's right. So only then is worship perfected, and what happened on Golgotha is finally completed, when the world becomes a world of love. That's when it's so. All of our spiritual growth and movement is toward that condition. And what's trying to stop us? Satan, because he hates. He it's impossible for him to love. It's impossible to have any kind of care for anybody or anything.
Yes.
And that's what people don't understand.
And it's his world.
It's his world. Yeah.
So God has to intervene for that to happen.
Yeah.
And you have to ask for it, want to. He won't force it on you.
So, you know, we got to use our free will to avoid that kind of thing. But I've heard people say, well, I don't want to go to heaven because I don't want to just sit around playing a harp all day. I want to go to hell where all my friends are going to be because I want to have fun, you know. And there was a priest in New York who was talking to a streetwalker one day, and he was trying to get her to leave that life, you know. And she says, well, I don't want to go to heaven. I want to go to hell because all my friends are going to be there. And he said, you don't understand what hell is. He said, hell is a place where love does not exist. You cannot even love yourself in hell. So whether your friends are there or not, you're going to hate them because you're also going to hate yourself. You cannot love in hell. Love does not exist in hell. And it shocked her when she heard that, you know. I don't know if it helped get her out of that life or not, but it really gave her, you know, pause when she thought about what that really meant, that she would spend eternity never loving anything, never being loved by anything, never even loving herself. That's a horrible way to think about love, you know. Think about life. So the liturgy goes a lot farther than mere moralism. The Lord has gone before us. He's our shepherd. He's leading in the flock. He has already done what we have to do. So he says, imitate me, for I am meek of humble of heart. He has opened a way that we ourselves could not have pioneered, because our powers do not extend to building a bridge to God. He had to build that bridge. He had to be that bridge. He is himself that bridge. He, through his holiness, makes us holy with the holiness none of us could ever give ourselves. That's why he tells us in that series we did on divine mercy, I have to be the one to sanctify your soul. I will sanctify your soul. Nobody else will sanctify your soul. Just me.
So I think a lot of times we just concentrate on God coming to save us from our original sin.
Right.
But really, it's all about the spiritual that you're talking about.
That's right.
Being a bridge, and we don't think about it.
That's right. It's all about spiritual growth.
Because if God just came to save us from original sin, he could have done it a different way.
Oh, he could have, yes.
So this is really what we should be thinking.
And it's like what other religion think, we're saved, that's it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It's once saved, always saved, yeah.
And yeah. Some people think.
And it's a delusion.
Yeah.
You know, when people think that way, it really is. They're deluding themselves into thinking they're a lot closer to heaven than they really are.
Yeah.
They think, well, all I got to do is accept Christ as my Lord and Savior and I'll be saved. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not the way it works.
The Father seemed cruel that he would force his son just to do that.
Yeah.
But he didn't force him. He accepted his
son. Yeah. Asked.
And that's why Lorenzo Scopoli, mm-hmm. back in the 1600s, I think it is, wrote a book called Spiritual Warfare.
Uh-huh.
And it's a beautiful book. It's still relevant today. And there's a priest that took his book and updated it to kind of modern times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Spiritual Warfare Revisited. And it's just Scopoli brought up to date, basically. And the main point he brings is that spiritual warfare is what happens inside of us. Mm-hmm. It's the warfare that we have within ourselves when every single time we make a choice between doing the right thing and doing something wrong, between doing something that's sinful and avoiding something that's sinful. That warfare is going on all the time. And so the closer we come to God, the more we think about God in our lives, the more we try to live the way he wants us to live, the less chance we have of falling into sin. The less time and energy we give to God, the more likely we are to fall into sin. And that's the one thing people don't think about.
Remind me of the Our Father. Lead us not into temptation.
Right.
Praying the Our Father. Praying.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. So we're going to stop here and pick up here next time. We talk about time and space and talk about how the liturgy has a kind of a time and space dimension to it. It's a movement thing. It's a progressive thing moving toward the final second coming. It's not a static thing that never, you know, just stands still.
Much bigger story. Stick around.
Anybody have any thoughts or any questions?
It's just my own.
Hey,
you're giving us information, but we're getting our spirituality.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We'll see.
You had mentioned about intention.
Yeah.
I thought that was not allowed in Catholicism, or was it maybe presented to me incorrectly?
Oh, it's allowed. Yeah, it's one of the forms of receiving the Eucharist, where in fact, it's a special chalice that has a bowl in the middle and like a tray around the side where you place the host, and then the priest would dip the host in the chalice and then give it to the recipient, but they have to receive it on the tongue. It's not used often. I've seen it used. I've used it myself as a Eucharistic minister. But it's not done at all often. It's too easy for somebody to accidentally hit the tray or spill the.
But I was taught the same thing he was, that it wasn't allowed.
Yeah, it's allowed, but you don't see it very often.
Well,
I think most priests only use it on special occasions or in special circumstances.
My husband was Episcopal, and they did it over there, but they had a choice.
Yeah. So it is allowed. It is allowed. Intention. Any other questions?
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
Jim, I had it at Holy Trinity, and I didn't realize what was going on.
Yeah.
And Father Vander would eat, and he just put everything, kind of pushed my hand down and put it in my mouth, and I was like,
yeah, you can,
didn't realize.
Yeah, once it gets dipped, you can't put it in somebody's hand. It has to go on the tongue.
Father Vander Woody likes to do it.
Father Vander Woody, yeah.
Yeah. He does. He did it, yeah.
He does that at Holy Trinity. So if you want to experience that, you can go to Mass at Holy Trinity, and Father Vander Woody will use intention to give you the Eucharist.
But he doesn't do it all the time.
I don't know. He probably does it.
I think because so many people are receiving in their hand now, he doesn't do it as much.
Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I know on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, he does the traditional Latin Mass there. So if you want to experience that, you can. I think it's at 6:30, the early Mass.
We don't go to that.
So, any other questions?
I'm just thinking.
Yeah, just a second. Benita?
There was a program on Newsmax of Mary, and it was about an hour long. And it's trying to tell you how Mary did have four sons and named daughters. And the oldest son was James. And the reason he didn't take Mary when Jesus was crucified was they had an explanation for the reason why she went to John the Evangelist. It was because he hadn't been saved, or he hadn't accepted Jesus as his Savior. That just sounded so hokey.
Well, it is hokey because it had nothing to do with that. If you remember, when Jesus was crucified, he was Jewish. Okay? He didn't become Christian at the Last Supper. He was Jewish at the Last Supper. He was Jewish when he was hung on the cross. Mary was Jewish when she stood at the foot of the cross. St. John was Jewish when he stood at the foot of the cross with her. Under Jewish law, a child of Mary would have had to take her into his home. John was not her child. John was the child of Zebedee. And John would have violated Jewish law to take Mary into his home if Mary had other children besides Jesus. And there's no way Jesus would ever have broken Jewish law. He never did that at any time in his life. He would never do it at the end.
They come up with this stuff. And they say that there's all these sons are named in the Gospels, John, Luke, or there were decided
well, yeah. to be a mom. Yeah, that's because in the Gospels it talks about Mary and Jesus' brothers. Mm-hmm. But that's because but that was because there was no word for cousin or aunt or uncle in that language. Everybody was a brother or a sister.
In Christ.
If you go back to Genesis, in the early account of Genesis, when it talks about Abraham and Lot, the first thing you come across, it says Lot is Abraham's brother. But then later on, you find out that Lot was actually the son of Abraham's brother. So Lot was his nephew. But they didn't have any word for nephew. And so in that tribal mentality among the Jewish people, the 12 tribes, everybody was called brother or sister, regardless of who your biological mother was or father was.
Why don't they get that?
Because they don't want to get it. If they actually got that and started, you know, believing it, they'd all become Catholic.
They don't want that.
They don't realize they're interpreting the Bible or whatever they're reading the way they want to interpret it.
Sure. Alan, you said a point?
Yeah. I actually heard Dennis Prager say the same exact thing, that when the Bible refers to brothers and sisters, it's usually cousins.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's like, they just want, that's why there's 43,000 of them.
That's right. We had a priest here for a while, if you remember, the little priest from Africa, mm-hmm. the little bitty guy. Okay, we had him over for Thanksgiving dinner when he was here, and we had some of my son's in-laws there also. They're Methodist, so it was an interesting dinner, and he was talking about his tribe and the things he went through, you know, but he was saying that within that tribe, they all still have that same custom. Everybody's a brother or sister. And so at one of his parishes, somebody was asking him, he had a picture of his tribe. Somebody took a picture of the whole little village. And he said, well, which of these people is your biological brother? He said, they're all my brothers and sisters. And he said, but which one is your biological brother? He said, I can't tell you. If I did that, I would be insulting all the others.
Oh,
interesting.
Were they intermarry?
No, because they just still have that same mentality. They still refer to everybody in the village as a brother and sister. Not because they intermarry, just because they have the same custom that the Jewish people had back then. If you belong to the tribe of Levi and somebody else belonged to the tribe of Jacob, you still call each other brother and sister.
Well, they do that at the Carmelite meeting. Like, we send emails to somebody, you know, you want a prayer request, and they always write, dear brothers and sisters in Carmel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. And isn't the Greek word philos mean brother or cousin?
It means relative. Yeah. Right.
How did men and women get married then? They have to marry outside the church or outside the religion?
No. Mm-mm. No, they get married. They had families that would get married. It's just that there was no word that they could use for cousin.
I know, but didn't they have to know who was the cousin? Who was
they did. They all knew. And don't forget, they didn't have last names back then. So you said, you know, like Peter was Simon Bar-Jonah. Simon, son of John.
Yeah.
Okay? He didn't have a last name. Jesus' last name was not Christ. Joseph was not Joseph Christ, and Mary was not Mary Christ.
No.
Okay? That was his title, the anointed one. That wasn't his name. Jesus the Christ, not Jesus Christ. So we'll close for today. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you, Jan.
See you next week.
Bye. Take care. Good night.